My cat, no. You don't do that.
Real funny. Look at all this stuff. Hanging over the stuff. What are these things? Well, you can draw pictures of my cat, but don't draw pictures of
my cat. My cat. Well, the first thing is, we will have class next week. Yeah, had a little something happen, so we will have class. So, well, it's kind of as long as I talk. Probably could be. But we do have class, so. Okay, we're in chapter 22. Sorry for the confusion and kind of back and forth, but it's kind of the way things worked out. Chapter 22, want to start with verses 13 to 21. We don't want to spend a whole lot of time on some of these things. If any man take a wife and go in unto her and hate her, doesn't sound like a very good beginning for this marriage. what do you even do with a statement like that? I mean, really. And give occasions of speech against her and bring up an evil name upon her and say, I took this woman, and when I came to her, I found her not a maid. And what this involves through verse 21 is a charge of premarital intercourse. And so he is finding out that he has not married a virgin. And maybe she confesses that, or when there wasn't a chance for her to become pregnant, she is now pregnant, misses several of her menstrual periods. In some cases, this is not always going to be the case, but virgins oftentimes bleed when they're first have sexual intercourse. That's not always the case. It's not some sort of infallible way to determine who's a virgin or who isn't. Yes? Chapter 22. And so it just goes through, and if he has found out about this premarital promiscuity, then he can... He has a right to deal with her in certain ways. And says verse 15, then shall the father of the damsel and her mother take and bring forth the tokens of the damsel's virginity unto the elders of the city in the gate. And the damsel's father shall say unto the elders, I gave my daughter unto this man to wife, and he hateth her. And lo, he hath given occasions of speech against her, saying, I found not thy daughter a maid, and yet these are the tokens of my daughter's virginity, and they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. This ties in with Numbers chapter 5, verses 12 to 31. Here, what the evidence amounts to would be bloodstains on her garments, showing that she has been having her menstrual flow of blood. this doesn't really sound like a real pleasant situation where the father is trying to prove the daughter's virginity. His husband is more or less trying to prove that she's not a maid, as the King James says, that is not a virgin. So it doesn't make for a real pleasant situation. And the elders of that city shall take that man and chastise him. Now that is if the evidence really proved that she was a virgin. And this evidently would involve a case where he's decided that he really doesn't want to marry her and continue to be married, or else he really does believe that she's not a virgin and he wants to put her away. But now the evidence says that she is a virgin. And see, we don't have any idea what really transpires in all of this kind of a situation. We're given very, very little information about it. The whole thing is where this man is feeling like he has not been treated fairly. In this case, the woman is a virgin and she's trying to prove it, and she has the assistance of her parents in doing that. I don't know exactly why we have things like this recorded. I don't know what we're really supposed to do with it. It shows dealing with things in a full, just manner, bringing evidence, discussing it, dealing with it openly, trying to find out what is really the truth in the matter. Maybe it's trying to show things in principle like that so that we see that we're to deal with things fairly and openly and honestly. I don't really know exactly why all of these things are recorded. I think some of it is showing us the kind of society they were to have and the way they were to handle things so that we have a better understanding of that people and that time. I think that might be some of the reason. And so they chastise him, and they shall immerse him in 100 shekels of silver and give them unto the father of the damsel, because he hath brought up an evil name upon a virgin of Israel, and she shall be his wife, and he may not put her away all his days. And so he has to pay a fine, basically, and he cannot put her away. So his charge is proven to be false, and so he has to continue in this marriage. So that's the way they dealt with that. Now, if it was true, he could put her away. But in this case, it's not true, and so he can't put her away. There's going to be some other things we look at regarding this as we go along, so it can even get a little bit more complicated. In verses 22 to 27, this involves fornication with engaged women. And so these are dealing with sexual type matters. If a man be found lying with a woman married to an husband, then they shall both of them die, both the man that lay with the woman and the woman, so shalt thou put away evil from Israel. And so because of this promiscuous act, in this case, put to death. If a damsel that is a virgin be betrothed unto a husband, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, then you shall bring them both out under the gate of that city, and you shall stone them with stones that they die. The damsel, because she cried not, being in the city, and the man, because he hath humbled his neighbor's wife, so shalt thou put away evil from among you. They were dealing with these things in a very severe way. Verse 25, but a man find a betrothed damsel in the field, and the man force her and lie with her, then the man only that lay with her shall die. If it happens in the city where she could have cried out for help and doesn't, then both are stoned. If it's out in the field where she really couldn't cry out for help, there'd be nobody to hear her, in that situation, then only this man is to be stoned. Only he is to be judged. So that's what's being dealt with there. Verses 28 and 29 says, if a man find a damsel that is a virgin, which is not betrothed, and lay hold on her and lie with her, and they be found, then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he hath humbled her. He may not put her away all his days. Now in Exodus chapter 22, verses 16 and 17, the father can refuse this marriage So he can intervene and say no to this marriage. Exodus chapter 22, verses 16 and 17. What is done here is not right as far as the sexual intercourse. But because it has happened and they've been joined together, then they're forced to be husband and wife. And in effect, that's like the punishment. And it's debatable whether or not, well, is this some sort of rape? I don't think this is any sort of rape. I can't imagine somebody raping this woman and now they have to get married. God is not going to be licensing anything like that or somehow going along with something like that. When it says lay a hold of, I think there's a mutual consent involved. And then because of this act, they're joined and they're to stay joined. And the only one that can intervene is the Father. And some of these things, they're not really easy to understand. We're not that connected to this society and to this time. And so some of these things seem rather strange. It doesn't tell us whether there's any sort of love. It doesn't tell us anything about their relationship. They're just kind of difficult situations to deal with, but they had to be dealt with. What we're finding is he is showing us all sorts of things that made up their society, all sorts of rights, all sorts of wrongs, all sorts of good things, all sorts of problems. And they had to have certain laws. These things were going to happen and they have to be dealt with in certain ways. There have to be punishments. There have to be deterrents. There have to be all sorts of things to deal with this. And some of the things we might feel like, well, maybe this would have been better. Maybe they should have done this. But God sees this society and he knows what their heart is. And so overall, he knows really how to deal with it. Although some of it may seem rather peculiar to us or strange or hard to understand. And so he's dealing with all of these things. And he deals with all of these things in a very straightforward manner. Deals with every single thing, step by step. And then, of course, there's many things that aren't even spoken of that they also had to deal with. And probably had all sorts of principles that they drew out of this and further carried out different difficult situations and problem situations in their society. Then in chapter 23, I want to look at verses 15 and 16. Thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto thee. He shall dwell with thee even among you in that place which he shall choose, in one of thy gates where it liketh him best. Thou shalt not oppress him. God is not in favor of human life sold to somebody else. And he doesn't want people that are once free put back under bondage again. It does show that God permitted slavery, but it's not his heart. There are so many things that we find God allowing and God permitting, but it isn't the way he really wanted it. That's really quite an amazing thing. This probably refers to slaves of foreign nations here, as well as Israelitish slaves. And perhaps the master had mistreated this person. And now he's free, and they're to allow him to stay free. But what our difficulty is with a lot of these statements is that there's not enough detail given. There's not enough explanation. So all we're able to really do is more or less guess. Verses 17 and 18, he says, there shall be no whore of the daughters of Israel, nor a sodomite of the sons of Israel. Thou shalt not bring the hire of a whore or the price of a dog into the house of the Lord thy God for any vow. For even both these are abomination unto the Lord thy God. And so he wants the things that are brought in as offerings, money given, tithes. He wants them to come from a right source, a proper source. And cult prostitution was very common in the Canaanite religions. And when he says there in verse 18, "Thou shalt not bring the hire of a whore or the price of a dog," a dog is referring to a male prostitute. He's talking about when he says, "No whore of the daughters of Israel, nor a sodomite of the sons of Israel." And then he talks about a whore again in verse 18 and the price of a dog. That corresponds to the sodomite of the sons of Israel of verse 17. He's not talking about somebody sold a dog and you can't bring any sort of an offering from the money you made on selling a dog. He's not talking about that. He's talking about what has been made from being a male prostitute. And he doesn't want anything that has come through such acts to then end up somehow going into the temple. He doesn't want anything like that. He doesn't want somebody from the mafia making loads of money deciding to pay a tithe and an offering to the church because of, you know, through drug operation, prostitute, other such things. God does not want that money. God doesn't need that money. It's not something that he desires. Verses 19 and 20 talks about no interest to people of the land, to brothers. "Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother." Usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. "Unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury." Those of the nation, they were not to be charged interest. Those of other nations, those of strangers, being part of Israel now, they could charge interest. He didn't want that for his own people. He didn't want them making money in this way. It's the way that banks and insurance companies and loads of other people make their money, charging interest. It is quite a clever scheme. It's making millions and billions of dollars yearly. And he didn't want that. It's quite a scheme. Interest is a phenomenal scheme. It works. It's making thousands and thousands of people extremely wealthy. Verses 21 to 23 talk about a vow. "When thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it." They're to perform the vow. Now, quick, rash oaths are discouraged. He doesn't want people to say yes and then not do what they've said they're going to do. He says, "Thou shalt not slack to pay it, for the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin to thee, be sin in thee. But if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee." That is, don't be quick to vow. Don't be quick to say, "This is what I'm going to do." Don't be quick to make some sort of an oath. Be careful. Be quick to hear and slow to speak. But when a person does make a vow, then they need to carry it out. It needs to be carried out. So that's what he's dealing with here. Regarding verses 24 and 25, you can compare Leviticus chapter 19, verses 9 and 10. So chapter 23, verses 24 and 25, you can compare Leviticus chapter 19, verses 9 and 10. "When thou comest into thy neighbor's vineyard, then thou mayest eat grapes, thy fill, at thine own pleasure, but shalt not put any in thy vessel." They can eat till the tum-tum is filled, but they can't store it up in some big shopping bag and carry it home as well, shopping cart, wheelbarrow, pickup truck, dump truck, train car load. "When thou comest in the standing corn of thy neighbor, then thou mayest pluck the ears with thine hand, but thou shalt not move a sickle under thy neighbor's standing corn." You can take some with the hand, but it's not time to bring in a harvester combine. That really wouldn't be all that considerate. God was providing for the hungry traveler. He's providing for the poor man, the man who is not able to have his own field. He's traveling or he's poor. And God wanted their needs met. Overall, it's showing the fields and the crop, the harvest, it belongs to God. And if God is loaning it to man, this one who's actually tilled the field, he can also loan, as were parts of it, to somebody else. Overall, he's teaching generosity. God is not stingy. He wants us to be like that. He wants us to be generous. Chapter 24 and verse 1 starts involving kind of an interesting topic here. When a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it in her hand and send her out of his house. Now this word uncleanness, New American Standard translates it indecency. The Hebrew means literally nudity. It comes from a root meaning to be bare. It carries the idea figuratively of disgrace and of blemish. So literally, nudity, and especially of the woman's external genital organs is what it's talking about literally. And then figuratively carries the idea of disgrace and blemish. There has been much debate as to what this is really talking about. Some say that it's just speaking about some sort of deformity or disease of the body. Others say that it's some sort of a moral problem, a moral uncleanness. So you've got two different views here. Somehow, when he looks at this woman and she's nude, naked, there's something about her that he doesn't like. Something wrong with her organs. There's something wrong with her body. There's some sort of deformity. That would be more the literal sense. The idea of blemish and disgrace in the figurative would be more a moral uncleanness. Some sort of a moral problem where she has done something wrong morally. Some sort of immoral thing. And so some say the one, some say the other. The law at first commanded that a woman guilty of fornication or adultery, she was to be stoned to death. That's what the law at first commanded. It appears that later the Jews allowed a man to put away his wife or betrothed wife. He could do that privately in the case of adultery or in the case of fornication, as did Joseph in Matthew chapter 1 and verse 19. But there are cases where others were stoned. And the Jews were divided at the time of Christ. And they tested Jesus on this. John chapter 8, verses 4 to 6. It has always been a controversial topic. It's Matthew 1:19, John 8, verses 4 to 6. At the time of Christ, there were two rival schools. The first school was the school of Hillel. H-I-L-L-E-L. H-I-L-L-E-L. And they laid stress on the clause, she find no favor in his eyes. They stressed that. Find no favor in his eyes. They taught that Israelites could divorce their wives really at their own pleasure for any cause, no matter how trivial. If there is something uncomely, some sort of defect of the person, some sort of a problem with her disposition, if she had some sort of an unsightly pimple on her face, he could divorce her. So she was praying that she'd have no acne problems. If she went out without a veil, if she was untidy or tasteless in her style of dress. Obviously, if she came home with a cat, there's no question about that. The overcooking of her husband's dinner, or just mere dissatisfaction with her manners. So it really kept her on her toes. Okay. So that was the school of Hillel. There is also the school of Shammai, S-C-H-A-M-M-A-I. I'm not sure what school we're of yet. We'll vote on it and decide. S-C-H-A-M-M-A-I. It laid stress on the fact that the only ground for divorce from this law was something criminal. So from this law here, from what is stated here, there had to be something criminal. And then there could be divorce. That is, the criminal act would be fornication or adultery. And I think the truth of the matter is, both of these schools really missed the main intention of the law originally. The school of Hillel, they missed it by a million miles. And they're more or less saying God wants divorce. For any reason whatsoever, go ahead and divorce. Don't deal with the problems in marriage. Don't solve the difficulties. Don't work through any of these things. If you just don't like something, no matter what it really amounts to, go ahead and get divorced. They really missed it. The school of Shammai, they also missed the heart of it. And they recognize that it's talking about something more serious. The school of Hillel is really making all sorts of trivial things the point of this law, which that's not the point of the law. The school of Shammai, when it focuses just on something criminal, in a sense, to just focus on that, that was a bit too strict, in a sense. But overall, they also missed it because the law originally said that if you do something like this, fornication or adultery, that person should be stoned. That your person should be killed. So neither school understood the heart of it at all. They missed the heart of the whole matter, really entirely, both schools. They were not in a place to understand God's heart in all of this. And their interpretations demonstrate that. Probably this law refers to some sort of physical deformity of the private parts, which when she stands before her husband as his wife, he dislikes her because of that deformity, and he sends her away. That is at least a good possibility, what it's dealing with. The term uncleanness is so ambiguous, it is very difficult to pin this thing down. What is he really talking about? The law may refer to any cause of a sufficient nature. See, any sort of a thing of a sufficient nature that works to cause a man's love for his wife to dissolve, where he just no longer loves her. It can't be some trivial thing. It can't be she's got a wart on her little toe. I mean, it has to be something that's significant. It cannot be that for any cause whatever, they could go ahead and get a divorce. And I don't think that he was reserving divorce just for fornication or adultery. I think it covered more than just that. But it didn't cover all the things that the first school said were valid reasons. The reason that God was permitting divorce is because of their hearts. That's why he permitted it. God didn't want divorce. He wanted them to work through the difficulties, solve the problems, trust him for help. But he recognized they weren't going to do that. And in one sense, he's saying, rather than have your lives be miserable, hate one another, end up hating me, because see, they'd end up, this happens a lot, they'd end up blaming God for the whole situation. So they end up hating God. turning against God. Bitterness can be a terrible thing. Blame can be a very tragic open door for all sorts of very serious problems, and where they backslide totally, end up hating God. So he said, now, and see, this is where the elders and the leaders of the nation, they were the ones that were going to have to deal with, now, is this a valid uncleanness? See, that's why he doesn't define it. You couldn't define it. You can't just say, now, in these three cases, I'll allow a bill of divorcement. It can't be done that way. Life can't be dealt with like that. It just can't be. Situations of life, they're just too complicated. There are valid situations for divorce. Now, see, it isn't God's will for divorce. But there end up being valid situations. There do. It just happens to be. You can say, well, it shouldn't be. But that misses the point. Well, that we should be able to believe God. Fine and dandy. But at times we can't. There are situations that come up where the only thing that will work is divorce. Just like there are situations where the only thing that would work is abortion. And other things. There are situations where you'd say, this is not God's will. This is not the right thing. But in these circumstances, it's all that can be done. And the person who won't consider things like that is not dealing things properly. They've got their pat answers are not going to work in life. Pat answers aren't going to work in life. They might work on Pluto, but they don't work on Earth. They might be fine on Mercury, but they're not going to work here in America. They're not going to work in this church. Pat answers aren't going to work overall. They're not. And he's not going to give lengthy lists of, now, this is the kind of situation, and here it is. See, then it would be, again, too restricted. He didn't give a word that just has one meaning. This is it. You know the application. He's not going to do that. And he was also, it shows how he puts it in the hands of those that are going to lead the nation. That's another thing that's very, very important here. There are all sorts of things that God does not deal with in the New Testament. He puts that in the hands of the church government. That's why we pray that the pastor and the elders and people in charge will have the mind of God. I have the heart of God. If there's anything that's important to pray for regarding a pastor and church government, is that they would have the heart of God. They would be reasonable. They'd be able to see how God's word applies in a practical sense, right down where we're at, where we're living. There may be some things that 5 years from now would no longer be acceptable. It would not be an acceptable way to deal with a certain problem. But we're not 5 years from now. We're right where we're at today. And things have to be dealt with where we're at today. They can't be dealt with how where we're going to be 5 years from now. And they can't be dealt with where we should be. Or where we could be. Or where we'd like to be. Can't be dealt with that way. Life cannot be dealt with that way. Now, that isn't throwing out God's law, and that isn't making everything relative. It's not. But it's understanding God's heart and how the law has to be applied based on the situation. Situations do change the applications of God's word to our lives. They just do. Some people, boy, they have a hard time with that. That is a tough thing. And I can understand why it's tough. We want absolutes. We want to know, now, what do we do in this? What about this? You can go through 5 zillion situations in just situations of life, whether dealing with another Christian, dealing with a husband, wife, children, whatever. You can say, now, what do you do in this situation? It depends. Well, what about this? It depends. What about this? It depends. It depends on all sorts of things. And people get too locked into this is what you do. And this is the pat answer, and it's always these steps, and this is what is always right, and this is how it's always handled. We'll never deal with people the way that God wants them dealt with. We never will. Not even close. So what this really amounts to, we don't know. I think it does involve adultery. I think it involves fornication. I think it involves other things as well. I think it's basically where the marriage is not going to work. Plain and simple, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. And so God, instead of kind of legislating them in by law to something that is totally not going to work. Now, in whose estimation? Whose estimation? Moses. The elders of Israel. Church government. Now, it's not a vote by the congregation. It isn't a vote by people, you know, in the situation, and we vote, our marriage isn't going to work, and then the church government, so to speak, has to accept our assessment. No, it's going to have to be something presented to the church, presented to Moses, presented to the elders, and then they're going to have to decide. And see, if the people would not accept then what the elders said, the church government, Moses, at that time, then they're going to be in a place where they'd be pushed out of the nation. See, then they would not be allowed to do this where it's been authorized and accepted and supported by the leadership in the nation. It isn't where it just comes down to the people and they decide. It wasn't a matter where they just decided. But it shows where God was trying to be reasonable. God sees where man is at. He's saying, okay, there are reasons where this marriage isn't going to work. Now, I'm not telling you what those reasons really are because they're going to vary. It's going to depend upon the situations. It's going to depend upon the people. It depends on the circumstances. And in those cases, I will allow divorce. I will allow that. Now, he says in verse 4 that she may not go back to a husband where she's been divorced. Her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. That's an abomination before the Lord. Thou shalt not cause the land to sin. He can't do that. She could marry somebody else, but she couldn't go back to him. When she has departed out of the house, she may go and be another man's wife. That's what it says in verse 2. If the latter husband hate her and write her a bill of divorcement, and give it into her hand and send her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, she can't go back to the first husband. If the second husband puts her away or dies, she can't go back to the first. God wasn't going to allow that. This is where they had to deal with the thing very soberly. They had to really give a lot of thought to this thing. And he wasn't going to have people getting divorced, get remarried, another divorce. I mean, he wasn't going to allow this to go on and on and on and on. But there were cases where he was going to allow it. And now I think overall that is because of their heart. And being in situations where they found themselves unable to really believe God. Really unable to respond to how God wanted to help them. But there may be cases where even in believing God, maybe the marriage couldn't be put back together. I mean, I don't know exactly. That seems rather remote. It would seem like if you had two people and they both really believed God and let God really work, God would be able to put the marriage back together. But maybe there are even some cases where that wouldn't happen. I don't know exactly. Overall, it's where their heart was no longer in a place where God was able to affect it. So the marriage wasn't going to work. And it's amazing to me, God accepts that. He accepts it. He acknowledges the situation for what it really is. I know that we're going to be in a lot of situations where we have to accept the situation for the way it really is. And we're going to have to accept the people for the way they really are in that situation. You're not going to be able to counsel by a book of theory. We're going to have to really assess life and face life and the way things really are and hope that overall, we're not deceived and viewing it through the wrong kind of glasses. That's what we're going to have to hope. But we're just going to be able to, all we can really do is deal with life the way we see it. And trust that we have a pastor and church government over us that will really help us so we can see life accurately. We have to really trust in all of that. Life isn't a real easy thing. And there are thousands and thousands of very difficult situations that come up. And this is a very difficult thing. When you talk about something like marriage, and you're to be with this person your whole life, and this is supposed to work and be beneficial, and it's not working, and then the person maybe starts to get bitter, have animosity, well, you really want this thing to lead to murder? You want this thing to lead to some other horrible thing? Some person completely turning against God? Or would it be better to say, this is the way that it is. I don't know what else to do. It seems like the only way out. And then it's evaluated by the elders there in Israel. They say, okay, under this, we'll accept that. And we'll let you do this. That isn't God condoning divorce. It isn't God willing divorce. It isn't Him ordaining divorce. But it is God dealing with people where they're at. I think that's a tremendous thing. I think that's a phenomenally wonderful thing. And I'm not saying now that we're to take this and apply that to people in our church. And now this is license for all sorts of divorces. But there are cases where divorce will be an acceptable thing because of the circumstances. We cannot write a law and just say it is not God's will under all circumstances, no divorce, no abortion, and list 10 or 15 other things like that. And just say, never, no way, can't be done, horrible sin, grievous way to act before God. We can't do that. Now, there are things that's exactly what they are. But there's a lot of things that people say are like that, and that's not the case in this situation. And it's not the case with these circumstances. Those are hard to deal with. You need to have the wisdom of Solomon, and the wisdom of Paul, and the wisdom of Peter, and the wisdom of God, plus the wisdom of about a couple million angels. That might help as well. We need help in the situations of life. Life should be a really simple thing. But life isn't all that simple. It's amazing how complicated life can be. And we can get so locked into, I did this, or I felt this way, I feel terrible about it, and not even really see the whole picture. I mean, see all the reasons, causes, things working behind the scenes. Don't even, a lot of times, have the slightest idea of what's really going on. We can feel so crummy about ourselves, and really we could see all the circumstances. We'd say, boy, I'm not doing all that bad. I'm doing pretty good. But we don't see all the circumstances. We just feel like we're doing a miserable job. We just don't know what's really going on day by day and everything that actually makes up our lives. We really don't. We like to think we do, but we don't. We don't. We don't know what's really going on. How many demons did you see today? What are they doing? You didn't see any of them. You didn't see a one. Nobody did. You didn't see them. And even the ones that you felt put things in your mind, how many more were working on you? How many of the emotions, how many of the thoughts, how many of the different things that came on you today? You really knew it was a demon. See, I mean, how much are we tuned into these things? How many angels did you see? We don't know really what's going on. How deeply has sin impacted us? What's going on really deep down inside? What are our longings? What are our needs? What are they really? Pretty hard to deal with. Very hard to deal with. Do we really even know who we are and what we really want in this life? We really don't. We really don't. These are difficult things. And so then you go through some of these passages of Scripture, and then people want absolute answers. You know, it's this way. It's not that way. These things are too complicated. And that's why it's written the way that it is. It's written in a very ambiguous way. And He never intended for us to go back and be able to interpret it right down to every single detail. He never intended that. Never. Not at all. Not even close. So, I think, see, portions of Scripture like this, to me, they demonstrate so much more what God's real heart is and the way God will deal with us. It tells me God really knows our frame. He understands things about people, and He takes that into consideration. It's the same thing where He gave the different statements about having a king. When you realize that He didn't want a king. But look, He tells them certain things that would help them have good kings. And would help those kings to do what was right. But yet it wasn't even His will. See, it shows God really dealing with man where man is at. That's an incredible thing. That's a really incredible thing. And we can have all sorts of conclusions. As people do certain things, we can say, well then, I mean, they'll never make the bride. They'll never be in the rapture. They're going to lose out with God. Is God really that small? Are you really that sure? Is that decision really mean they're going to miss the rapture? When is the rapture? How far off? How many more years? What is God going to be able to do between now and the rapture? This decision means they're out of luck? They've lost out? Really? We're that positive? We're that sure? How can we be so sure? How do we know? We don't know a lot of things, but yet we make some phenomenally dogmatic statements. It's amazing some of the things we say, as though they're absolutes right from heaven. As though that we were standing right up there at the judgment seat and heard God Himself say it. You have lost out. It's like we think we heard Him say that. And we go and, you know, I mean, sure, the person puts themselves in a precarious place, but they really have lost out? They're not going to make it? Really? See, I don't know. Do you know? They're difficult things, aren't they? Very difficult. And it's not good that people make certain decisions, but is God all done dealing with them? See? Is God all done dealing with Mike Sabrin? He's all done. He's decided not to teach. He's not attending the church. God's all done with him. He's now not going to make the rapture. You know, where's he really going to end up? I don't know. Do you? Now, I'm not saying it's a good thing. It's obviously not a good thing. But God's not done with him. God's not finished. Who knows what's going to happen the next year? Who knows what's going to happen the next 5 years? Who knows exactly? See, certain things have been difficult. He's had to make these decisions, but God's not done. He's not leaving God. He's not turning away from God. He's not turning away from, don't get this wrong, but he's not turning away from the only church that will get him into the rapture. So, I mean, these things are bigger than what we really understand. They're more complicated. That's the way life is. And I don't fully understand them. I don't know how to fully assess them. But I'm not going to make these kind of statements that just kind of say, you know, God can't do anything more. They've made this decision that's going to now ruin their whole life. Or, you know, they're locked in this. You've got to do this. Some of these things are just, they just can't be really dealt with like that. They can't be evaluated like that. Then instead of still feeling love for that person and acceptance for that person and understanding, we basically feel, hey, he's rejected. And we end up more or less rejecting the person as well. You know, like they made this horrible decision. Well, it may be a very horrible decision, in a manner of speaking. It might be one of the worst decisions he's ever made. But God still loves him. God still accepts him. God's still for him. God understands why. I think we should have at least that kind of an attitude. One of acceptance, one of love, one of support, even in the wrong decision. I don't mean of condoning a wrong decision, but still of support, meaning that we're still for him. We still love him. You know, that kind of a thing. You know, they're difficult things to deal with. Boy, they're difficult things. I mean, wow, are they difficult? Ah, they're really difficult. Oh, it's because you pull out your hair. But it's part of life. Life's a lot different than I thought it was ever going to be. When I was in junior high, I never thought it'd be like this. Boy, life in junior high, that was a breeze. I thought when I was 18, I knew the answers to life. Wow. Life has become quite amazing. All these different things. Hard to deal with. But see, God knows. He knows how to assess it. He knows how to deal with it. And we can trust Him in that. And He'll help us in these things. Verse 6. No man shall take the nether or the upper millstone to pledge. For he taketh a man's life to pledge. Now what he's talking about here is the millstones involved in grinding grain into flour to make bread. And if they didn't have these millstones, if they took the top part or the bottom part, they were taking away the person's means of being able to feed themselves. They wouldn't be able to prepare the grain properly. If a person has an item like this, which is really their source of life, the source by which they sustain themselves, and we take that away from them, what have we done? We take their life away. Now, see, this would be a pledge, like in where they had borrowed money. They were putting this down as like collateral. You couldn't take something like this. You could never take anything away that would threaten their life, that would put their life in jeopardy. That's not the way to deal with a human being. That's what his point is. Well, we'll start with verse 7 in about 5 minutes.